Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, welcome to Teach Me to Talk with Laura and Kate. I'm Laura Mize, pediatric speech-language pathologist.
And I'm Kate Hensler, developmental interventionist with the First Steps program in Louisville, Kentucky. How are you tonight, Miss Laura?
I'm good. I was just telling you, though, I'm a teeny bit groggy from a late afternoon nap, so I hope I can pep it up and rise to the occasion.
You will, you will. Once we get going, we always get excited.
I know. So how are you?
I'm good. We had a very busy but fun and productive weekend.
You did? Do you want to detail that or no?
Well, we did the trolley hop thing on Friday night in Crescent
Hill.
Oh,
fun.
And then, yeah, and we got lots of decorative, like, stuff done at the house, so that was nice. So it's, I can officially say it's looking better than it ever has before. It's not done, but it's coming together.
Uh-huh.
And then we had a friend who had eye surgery over for dinner Saturday night, so we entertained a little bit and cooked a little bit. So that's about it, just house stuff and fun stuff.
That's good. That's
yeah.
good. I feel like I haven't talked to you in days.
Well, you had a busy week, too.
I did. We finally have confirmed our upcoming conference for West Virginia that I've been lamenting over for several, I would say weeks, but actually West Virginia has been back and forth. It's almost like months now. But we are officially scheduled for Thursday, September 15th in Charleston at the Marriott downtown. I do not have the registration up on the website, but that is moving to the top of the to-do list. So if you are interested in registering for that date, I hope that you'll check the website, and that should be up by in the morning so that you can go ahead and register for that. And so I'm thrilled about that and really excited that that's scheduled, and we're firming up our other locations. And my plea from last week still stands. If you are a speech pathologist in the Texas Early Intervention System, I would love to hear from you. Please email me so that I can ask you some questions about your state and get some information that would help me as we're pondering dates and locations for Texas as well. So I hope that someone will hear this and respond. Any other kind of announcement things that you could think of, Kate? Any updates that you want to do before we move right into tonight's topic?
No, I'm good.
All righty, we'll just move right ahead then. Last week we didn't get to this question, and it's been our second question for a long time because I looked at this speech pathologist sent me this email back on June 29th. So for a month we've been saying we're going to do this question, and some of the things that we'll talk about tonight I think are an overlap from last week. And sometimes I feel like that happens pretty frequently, don't you, Kate, where we're talking about something, and as I'm saying it, I'll think, did I just say that last week, too? So, in case.
That or we just like the same topics, so we tend to be somewhat repetitive. The same topics get us going each time.
Isn't that funny? So, some of these things will be things that we also talked about last week. And so when that starts to happen, one of us should really say, but if you need more information about that, listen to last week's show. So it won't be a complete repetition. And then if we get finished with this question, a longtime listener asked me this week if I could remember the date that we talked about the stages of play. Do you remember doing that, Kate, a long time ago? I just sent you an email about that, but you may not have gotten that because, I mean, I sent it like 10 minutes ago. But it was a long time ago that we talked about this. And I am terrible about being able to dig through the archives, you know, and remember when we did what show, whatever. But I just happened to, I guess, remember what we called, you know, stages of play. And I looked through the old shows and through emails to you, and we did that topic back in October of 2009. So it's so funny that someone would remember that and say, can you please repeat that information? So if we don't get to, or really she wanted me just to tell her what show that was on, and again, it's from October 2009. I think it was around be, October 14th, 2009. So she may be able to go back and listen to that show again, but we're going to give that information a fresh spin if we get to that tonight. And if we don't get to that tonight, it certainly will be what our show will be about next week. So do you even remember that, Kate? Isn't that funny that someone would remember a show from that long ago?
Only vaguely, and I certainly couldn't have told you when it was, that's for sure.
Well, I only did it because I am pretty obsessive about saving, especially emails about the show, and to you, because that's happened before where somebody will ask me a question, when was that show about blah, blah, and it's easier to go back and look at those emails. And so, again, I was excited that I could actually dig that up. So many times, though, I'll title a show something and think we're going to talk about something, and then we talk about something totally different. So I'm glad that I remembered this one and could dig through enough that it was actually what it was supposed to be. So that was
good.
Exciting. All right, so let's do this email, and it's from a speech pathologist named Becky. And she said, I recently came across your website when I was looking for ideas to expand expressive communication with toddlers. I was looking for some ideas on how to get toddlers to use their words to communicate instead of relying on signing, pointing, and gestures. I have a couple of toddlers on my caseload that can pronounce words correctly, but it seems like they are choosing not to speak to communicate with others. Any ideas that you can provide would be greatly appreciated. Thank you. And my reply to her pretty much started with, hey, that's what the whole website is about. So take a look at every stinking article on there, because that's what we talk about a lot, and certainly on the show, and I've written a lot about that as well. And I pointed her in the direction of a couple of articles on there. And if you are not familiar with my website at teachmetotalk.com, the expressive language category, all of the articles that I'm going to reference and that we'll talk about have specific posts dedicated to these five or six ideas that we're going to run through tonight. So you can take a look at those, and I'll try to reference the article title so you can go back and read those for yourself. But I think we should begin by talking about... And
no, wait, what's
boy,
the article, what are you saying about the article, Laura? You lost me there.
I'm saying I'm going to give five or six different articles with ideas in them, and
Just
talk about what those ideas are a little bit.
Okay.
Yeah, it would have been nice if I'd gotten this to you in time to actually look at it, wouldn't it?
I have it now. I could look now, huh? I did look about 30 minutes ago, and there wasn't anything new, so I thought, oh, well.
Well, yes, I was just waking from my nap at that point, huh? Okay. But the first thing, and we talk about this all the time, and I think we talked about it last week, too, is sometimes we assume they're choosing not to talk rather than they really can't talk. And, you know, I call that can't versus won't, and I do think we reviewed that a lot last week. But it really sometimes even therapists and parents really make this mistake a lot. They'll think he could say that if he wanted to. She has the ability to produce this word, but she just won't. She's either holding out or she's – sometimes parents will think that a child is just purposefully choosing to push their buttons and not talk, you know, meaning, oh, he knows it gets on my nerves, so he's just not going to say it. He is purposefully manipulating me. And we all agree that toddlers can be a handful sometimes behaviorally. However, I really don't make the assumption that a kid is choosing not to talk. And I do think we talked about this last week with, you know, when you choose not to talk, that's called selective mutism, and you don't have very many children on your caseloads who have that diagnosis, because you have to be able to demonstrate that you have age-appropriate speech and language in at least one setting before you could get a diagnosis like that. So thinking that a two-year-old is purposefully and willfully choosing not to talk, it can get you in a lot of trouble, because then you end up trying to treat it behaviorally rather than looking at it as a developmental problem. And so the first thing that I think she should do is not make that assumption unless she has heard a child say that particular word lots and lots of times. You can't really say even then, even when you've heard them say it a lot of our little friends with apraxia, and we talked about this last week too, can pop out a word in a certain circumstance and then may not be able to use that same word the next week in the session or even 2 minutes later until they really, really own that word, which is exactly the verbiage that we used last week to talk about that. So I really hope that she's making a big distinction between and being really careful about assuming that the kid can say the word and is just choosing not to. So that would be the first article that I would point her toward, is that can't versus won't article, to really, really solidify in her mind that we choose to treat speech language delays and disorders as a developmental issue and problem and challenge rather than a behavioral challenge and approach. Because when you start looking at it that way, then you start pushing and setting up power struggles and all those little things. And you, when you look at it from another perspective, from the he can't do it yet, and especially when we help parents change their minds about that, then they start looking for ways to help the child, and our strategies are usually more productive rather than he just can't, you know, he won't do it for me and I'm just going to make it. So that being said, that's where I would direct her first, is to really look at that and make sure that philosophically she's approaching these kids from the right standpoint of, uh-oh, it's he can't talk, not that he won't talk. So that's kind of the first little caveat, I would say. And I think that
I'm very relieved to hear you say that, Laura, because when I read that question, my first thought was, you know, I don't feel like I have many kids on my caseload at all that choose not to. I mean, you know, we have good days and bad days, and some days
right.
It's easier than others, but I almost never look at it that way. I almost
because
always lean towards
you look at it the other way.
Uh-huh.
You're starting from a different point. I mean,
mm-hmm.
You're starting from the assumption he can't do it or else I wouldn't be here.
Right.
You know what I mean? Yeah. Don't you
and
think
I
that's
certainly
my,
see that kids vary from session to session, and even within 1 hour session, you know,
Yeah. You
have all different types. Some need to be warmed up. Some start out with like gangbusters and then kind of hit a wall and they're kind of done.
Yeah.
You know, they have
their
own little style, but rarely do I think, now I know this kid can and he just won't right now. And it's in the way she kind of words her question, it sounds like she thinks that's fairly common, at least with certain kids on her caseload. And I really don't think
I don't
that.
Care.
I no. Okay, good.
Yeah, I don't think that hardly at all. And again, I really do point people back to this. If that were true, that would be called selective mutism. And
mm-hmm.
that's rare. You see that
uh-huh.
like, you know, I've said this on the show too. I've seen it once in my long career. And so that's not something, you know, when kids are willfully choosing not to talk. And sometimes, and this is a point that we started making last week too, that I wanted us to really talk about tonight and continue with this. Sometimes it's that the kid is really, really shy. And so you're thinking, because and a therapist or an adult is looking at a kid who really is kind of pulling inward and pulling away from you, and sometimes these are the kids that hang on to their mothers for dear life, and they're cuddled up on their mommies, and they're so super focused on that, and I think about those kids as just really being so shy and just kind of a temperament difference, and that's totally different from he just won't do it, he's purposefully choosing not to talk. That's
mm-hmm.
that you haven't gotten them comfortable enough with you yet. And so, and we started talking about this last week at the end of the show, where I was giving the example that remember the previous week I had been in Memphis, and the program chair from the university that I went to and got my undergraduate degree said that she really liked how affectionate I loved that I was with children, and she loves to see that, and she thinks that, and remember at the end of the show when we were talking about this, Kate, about
right.
how, yeah, and I really think with those kinds of kids especially that don't seem quite comfortable with you being, you know, fun, which, my goodness, we talk about that every single week, but really being openly affectionate and very making yourself so fun and so approachable so that those children can barely, you know, they can not resist playing with you and wanting to interact with you and eventually communicating with you so that you break down those barriers and whatever that is. And a lot of therapists, again, will see a child that looks that reserved and that shy or passive or clingy to mom and really, again, want to treat that by doing, you know, making the child respond differently to the same darn situation rather than changing the situation. So that the therapist, again, is oozing approachability. Is that a real word? Or just, you know, being so warm and loving and open enough so that the child feels so comfortable that they want to interact with you. Take over, Kate, and talk about that a little bit because I am struggling for the right words to express what I want to say here.
Well, I think your professor, a former professor, was making the point that she doesn't see that very much in her clinicals now or with the gals she's training now, and we kind of talked about, you know, the movement is towards being more professional, and you know, I get that. There was a lot of that when I was in nursing school about being professional, and I remember I had a training, or I had an assignment as a nursing student, and I had to go to a school and do health education type things, and I did first graders and about brushing teeth, and really enjoyed it, and I guess that was my little, you like young kids, this would be, you know, this kind of foreshadowing for where I ended up ultimately. But my professor who had to observe me, and she was one of those very professional type ladies and all about nurses being professionals, and she said, I had done a great job, but I'd made a huge mistake and called one of the girls sweetie and one of the girls honey or something like that, and she chastised me for, you know, and I thought at the time, well, isn't that just ridiculous? They're first graders. Now, come on. You can't call a first grader sweetheart or, you know. And I think that even in among therapists who are not just students but those who are in the trenches working, I think there is a group of a fairly large, sizable group of therapists who feel like it's not professional to cuddle with them and snuggle them and give them kisses and let them give you kisses and to use food even because that's not professional. And then my response, should I be lucky enough to actually give one, would be, they're two, you know.
Yeah.
He's
a baby.
Yeah. They're very young children, you know. I could see where, no, that might not be appropriate with a 7 or 8 or a 9-year-old kid in a public school setting. On the other hand, when you're sitting in their living room and you're trying to do everything you can do to engage them, and these are kids who don't always engage easily or comfortably, and, you know, that's certainly part of getting a child to communicate, as you well know. And if you can't start there, how do you get a 2-year-old to let his or her guard down and to warm up to you and to be in the right place to communicate? So,
exactly.
You know, it's sad that, you know, that's not only something that she sees in school, that's something we see in the trenches sometimes, is that therapists feel like that's not professional. You know.
I know. And sometimes when you work on a team, when somebody has, and maybe it's just kind of an inherent personality thing, they're not warm and fuzzy or, you know, highly physically affectionate with hardly anyone. And so I think it's a real contrast. I've had lots of moms say to me and really look me in the eye and say, I can tell you like my kid.
Mm-hmm.
I can tell you like him. And sometimes they haven't really felt that from every other, or maybe not every other, but another person. And so it's a real contrast for them to see, you know, and you don't want to look at her and say, well, that's how I am with every single kid I see, and that's kind of how I am in my real life
anyway.
That's my
routine. Yeah.
This is how how I do it. But at the same time, parents so genuinely appreciate that because they want to know that somebody cares about their kid besides them. And so establishing that initial social, emotional, whatever connection you want to call it, is almost more important initially than any other thing that I think we can do as early interventionists. And it certainly, oh, it certainly makes such a big impression with a parent who wants to see her child succeed and wants, you know, wants to see her kid be able to communicate. And again, establishing that connection is first. We talk all the time about how important that social connection is. And so, especially with those kids that you think for whatever reason aren't connecting with you, and even if you do, just can't, you can hardly stop yourself from thinking that it's behavioral and that you want to change it, and you know, instead of prying them out of their mother's arms or sending mom out of the room or whatever else you want to do, you have to make yourself so fun and start by changing you and how you do it and how you act and behave so that that kid wants to be with you more than any other thing he could do, whether it be blowing you off again or being too afraid to leave mom. A lot of therapists in Mississippi asked me, and in Georgia too when I was in Atlanta, and we had talked about this last week as well, about how I got lots of questions between breaks versus during the session. And I bet three different people in Memphis at three different times said, what do you do with a mom, with a kid who's just so dependent on mom and just clings? You know, do you make mom leave the room? You know, and I always want to say, well, it really depends on the kid. But before I banish mom, you know, I really want moms to be there and see what we're doing so that they can carry it over. So before I would, but there are some kids who have such difficulty separating that you do have to eventually kind of make that switch. But that's not something that I have an issue with all the time with kids, because I try to do everything I can to make the kid want to be with me and connect with me and play with me, so that that's the fun part and I'm not having to pry him off mom's lap. One person that talked to me about that, or actually I think two people in Memphis, were in clinical situations, so the kids are coming to them, and I think that's a little more difficult than when you're seeing a kid at home and it's on their home turf.
Right.
Yeah, so that would be a totally different situation. And even then, I told both those women, I would still have mom participate, but if he really won't get out of her lap, and one person said that the child, you know, really just pretty much buries his head in mom's chest and won't even look at her, that might be a situation where you might have to just cut the cord so that you can get him to move on. But still, I would try before I didn't have mom participate in the room. I would do everything I could to make sure that I was so fun that he would want to be with me first. And I think that goes with establishing that connection. And I asked her, had she ever held him, would he sit in her lap? And she said, oh, no, I haven't even tried to do that. And I hold kids a lot. And a few weeks ago, you told me that you were, or maybe it was longer than that, that you were holding kids more than you had before.
Right.
Maybe you said that on the show. I don't remember. But I hold kids all the time. And if they want to feel that cuddly lap, you know, if that's what they're missing, I want it to be mine instead of mom, so that he's wants to be there with me and is playing with me and interacting with me, and we're not, you know, fighting that whole mommy obsession thing.
Right. I, you were joking about saying to a mom, and I know you don't say it, but when you were saying, oh, that's how I am with all the kids. there's some truth to that. And for me, Laura, you know, I think I'm not as demonstrative as you are. I am not as warm and fuzzy and cuddly with little kids. But it is certainly something that I have, not that I was ever afraid of kids. I mean, I had kids when I started this job, but that wasn't my natural inclination, I don't think, as, you know, by nature,
right,
as much as it has been yours always. But it is something that I have cultivated and that I have become more comfortable with, because I see, hey, it works, you know.
Right.
And I can't say I do it with every child, But I do it with lots of the kids I see, and sometimes it really, really helps them bond with you, warm up with you, let their guard down. It also helps with those kids who have such trouble attending because they're kind of crawling in their little, out of their little skin, you know. They're just
right,
those movers. They're constantly seeking some kind of input, and it's usually across the room when you're trying to get them. And
yeah,
those are the kids that I think I am doing a lot more of the, oh, well, let's just sit in my lap and I'll give you a little deep pressure in your shoulders while we do this puzzle or while we look at this book or while we do whatever it is. And, yeah, I've gotten to be much more comfortable with it. Not that I was ever, you know, it can be kind of intimidating if a kid is really standoffish, and that would be a kid I probably wouldn't just reach right for and stick him in my lap. But it's gotten easier for me, so I know that people can learn to be more comfortable, and you have to kind of hone your instincts about which kids take it and, you know, which
right,
approach is going to work with which kid. And sometimes these scariest kids, and by scary I mean they seem to have the most obvious social issues, they're very, very sensitive. Those are the kids I think a lot of times that therapists naturally back away from because they're kind of intimidating kids, and it's easy
right,
to see that, ooh, they're really sensitive, and I don't wanna mess up.
I wanna upset them. Yeah.
Yeah, because then they know they're in trouble, and really those are the kids I find a lot of times that you have to be really very confident and really kind of forward with your
right,
your approaches or attempts to engage the child and kind of steel yourself to some extent about with, you know, to their negative reactions, because sometimes they almost, you know, they do them, but if you're adept at dealing with them, they can let their guard down pretty quickly. And I don't know what I'm trying to say, but
but I know what you mean. And sometimes the very kids that you think, oh, he's not really liking me very much, I'm not very good at this with him, those are the kids you just need to dive in and
right,
instead of really backing away from, do the opposite. Get right in their little faces, right in their space. If they will let you hold them, hold them. If they won't, and I don't hold every kid, I'd rather them be looking at me. But if it's a kid that's, we were talking about initially, really shy, or a kid who is having lots and lots of difficulty making that initial emotional connection to you, those are the kids that you might try it a little bit with. And a lot of times, again, like you said, the kids who are really attention challenged because of their sensory system needs, if you do lots of hugging and snuggling, they will stay with you for longer than if kind of left to their own devices, because they get distracted by something they see visually or that inner need to kind of move, seek.
Yeah,
so holding in that situation
right
works
down
too,
and just chill right out in your lap, and you think, whoa, look how long you did that puzzle, or look how, you know,
yeah,
it's amazing how
and you think, yeah, you think, why didn't I do that 15 minutes ago before I broke
mm-hmm,
out in sweat? Yeah,
uh-huh.
Chasing him all over this room. Yeah. Why didn't I think of that? Yeah.
Yeah. It doesn't always work, but it works a lot.
It does work a lot. And if you have a kid that's kind of resisting that, I won't hold a kid who's obviously kicking and scratching and screaming to get up. But sometimes, like you said, you'll have to just kind of plop them right down there. And you might do something like ring around the rosies or hold their hands and jump first, or do some things first, kind of where you're standing up, but you're holding their hands, or you're maybe even picking them up and throwing them in the air, so you touch them several times first, and then just kind of whirl them around and sit them down in your lap and bring out that next toy almost before they even have a chance to think, I want to get away from you. That's how I do it a lot.
Right.
With
so
that
it's kind
of kid,
playful, and you're kind of, you know, there's some movement anyway, and then, boom, you've
right,
got them in your lap. You have the toy ready. You know, you've
yeah,
got their attention. You've kind of settled them down, and they sometimes just kind of melt right into you and attend, and you think, ooh, that worked really well.
Yeah. Hold my breath. Move
that was
on.
The longest
hurry before
that
he
kid has ever
it,
attended to one thing since I've met him. Yep, because he was
yeah,
sitting in your
yeah,
lap.
But it does take, like you said, honing your instincts to know when mm-hmm. it's effective and when it's not. And if you screw up, that's okay. Just try it again in a few minutes, you know, after you've done something else or moved on to whatever he wanted to do. And again, I wouldn't necessarily fight a kid to make him do it, but I would certainly try it enough so that they get more comfortable with that. All right, so that was the second thing, is that she should try to be more affectionate with some of those kids who seem like, if it's because they're reserved, because they're shy, and they're reverting to that pointing, and that happens a lot. Haven't you seen those really shy kind of, sometimes they're not always passive, but they're just really reluctant to interact with you because, and they rely on that pointing or gestures, excuse me, or even signs more so than their words because it's, they're not warmed up yet.
Right.
They're not, so she should try to be more affectionate. Last week we talked a lot about getting kids warmed up, meaning that, and you, it was at the end of the show where you were saying, Laura, you didn't really talk about maybe she should move the kid a little bit more. So that would be an idea for this person too. And isn't it interesting how these same ideas overlap from week to week, from situation to situation? But getting kids really ready to interact and talk sometimes really has a physical component. So we've talked a lot last week, and then, you know, on the website there's some, I don't even know what article it would be in. Maybe it'll come to me in a minute. I think it's under the what works and what doesn't work strategies in the expressive language section. Those are names of articles, what works and then what doesn't work to help kids talk. And in those articles, as we discussed last week, doing a movement activity to kind of rev them up will so many times help a kid that looks like he's stuck with gestures or signing or whatever. You get their, as you always say, Kate, their motors running, their affect level going, you get them pepped up, revved up, they're going to be more apt to respond verbally than if they were so passive and just sitting and not really, they're not really into play with you. And so we talked a lot last week about getting them prepped and getting them to the point where they can, again, give you their best response. And for some kids, you'll take a sign or a gesture or a point, but again, remember her, she's coming from the perspective that these are kids that she really believes can talk. So sometimes with those kids, when they're not talking, and we talked a lot about last week about where you can't just walk in and start with where you left off last week. You have to get them ready for that and do the same activities, or again, you know, perhaps introduce even a new movement activity or something that you get them going and get them kind of back to the spot that they were in last week, so
and
that
I
they
do that
are
with a lot of those kids
again.
Those kind of maybe borderline, you know, is it a shy thing, is it a
right.
low arousal thing, sometimes it's kind of both, whatever, they're just kind of flat kids, at least upon arrival. Oftentimes they're flat kids. Maybe they've been watching TV for 2 hours. Maybe they just woke up. Maybe that's
right.
just kind of how their system is working at this point. But with those kids, I always try to remember to hit the ground running. I'm going to get the balloons out. I'm going to get the bubbles
right.
out. I'm going to do ring around the rosy. I'm going to tickle them. I'm going to, because they're flat, you know, it's like, no,
right.
you got to get them get them going. Got
to get them going, yeah.
Yeah. And
yeah,
I
so
wonder, you know,
some...
when
Go
this
ahead.
Speech therapist who wrote in, that's what I kind of wonder. When did you hear the words? How consistent are the words? Were the words in a different situation where the child was primed and ready to go and you heard the words and then you're back and you think, I know he can say them? I'd say, well, do you have them in the same place you had them in the last time you heard them? Because
right. Yeah, from a regulatory perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, that's what we're talking about. And you can't really walk in the door and say, okay, let's sit down and you tell me those 5 words you said last week. You know, you've got to have it in the same context with play or whatever, and like we were talking about, their regulatory, emotional, wherever they were at that point, then you've got to get them back to that place a lot of times before they're able to use those same words. And that's hard to remember and hard to do if you have not thought about it in that way. The other suggestion that I made to her was to use choices, especially for words that she thinks a kid can say that he hasn't said again. And usually we use choices, and I think we talked about this last week too, in the context of activities so that you keep those choices going and so that you're asking the kid, you know, are we going to play bubbles or balloons? Are we going to play potato heads or choo-choos? Are we going to play babies or whatever, so that they choose. And again, choices are so effective because you're not relying on the child to use the word spontaneously. He can see the visual thing that you're asking him, especially if you're, you know, holding those two items up and giving him a choice. And then you are modeling for him the word so that he's not just, again, trying to kind of come up with that word on his own. That happens a lot where a parent or a therapist thinks that a kid really can say the word spontaneously because they've heard him imitate it two or three times. And for many, many kids, they have to imitate it for a long time before they can ever be able to say the word spontaneously or on their own. So choices give the child the opportunity to hear the word, and you're modeling the word for them to imitate. So that would be something that I would really encourage her to look at. But she has to make sure that, one, the kid can imitate before she starts using choices. And sometimes therapists use choices too soon. If you've never heard a kid say a word, it hardly ever happens the first time you bring out a toy and say, do you want to play X or Y? Usually you've heard that word when they've just imitated your high-energy models as you're playing rather than the very beginning of an activity. Don't you think, Kate?
Right. Yeah. Not the kids we see. I mean, if it were that easy, we wouldn't be there, you know.
Isn't that the truth? Because surely their moms thought of that, yeah.
Right, you know. That
yeah.
would be really, and certainly typically developing language kids, that wouldn't be out of the realm of possibility at all. Two words,
right.
Even if they didn't know what they were or ever played with them, if you held them up, gave them a choice, they might very well respond by giving you back the choice that they've never heard or seen or said before, but not
our
kids. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and we talked about last week that hierarchy to move a kid through imitation, that you can't really sometimes even start with real words, with those nouns that I was just talking about. You know, are we going to play babies or puzzle? You know, they're not ready for that. You've got to work your way up that hierarchy so that they're doing lots of other kinds of either motor imitations or exclamatory play words that we talked about last week. So if this is new information, you've never heard this before, after this show, go back and listen to last week's show so that you can hear how you move kids through that hierarchy so that you get them ready to imitate. Because if a kid can't imitate the words that you're saying, that may be why he's relying on those gestures, because that's all he has. He can't say it yet. So make sure that you've taught them how to imitate. The other thing I think that happens with this is that sometimes they've gotten so locked into not responding verbally with choices that, you know, their moms know that they can't talk, and so somebody has told them, we'll give them choices, so they just, their one-trick pony is, I'm going to point and grunt, and so they've just gotten used to responding that way when somebody gives them choices. So I don't give a lot of choices for a kid to sign or talk for at the beginning. I wait until we're kind of moving along with therapy. Do you know what I mean by that, Kate? Don't you just kind of dictate at the beginning? Not so much dictate, that's too strong of a word, but you pretty much will pull out a toy and you play with it, and then you pull out the next toy and you play with it. You're not really using choices right away at the very beginning.
No, I'm not.
For lots of kids, are you? I'm not either. Because
mm-hmm.
I think you can almost train them to think that a point and a grunt is okay. And so, and again, for some of our kids, if the first day we see them point, I just want to do, you know, backflips because I'm so excited that they've used a gesture to do that. But she's not talking about that kind of kid. She's talking about the kind of kid that only wants to rely on that. So she's, what she might have done is started that a little too soon with if she's used choices, if she were talking to us and she might say, no, I already give them choices all the time, I would say, well, then don't do that with your next kids. Don't give them choices until they're really ready to verbally imitate. Or if you're working hard on signs, you know, if that's your goal, of course you would accept that. But sometimes I think you can start choices too soon so that they really get into the habit of, all I have to do is point, and that's going to be good enough. Because they've done that with mom, they've done that with you. They don't realize that you've upped the ante a little bit. Does that make sense?
Yes. Yeah, and I don't know. I guess I move to choices more when I kind of feel like, okay, he's become a good imitator, but
yes.
I'm not hearing that much spontaneously. So that's kind of the stopgap. You know, what are we going to do to get him there?
Me too. And the, mm-hmm. Yeah, and I don't use choices right at the very beginning with kids because they do lapse into the whole point and grunt thing where mm-hmm. they, you know, I want to save that for when they're really, really ready. And in the conference, and I think we probably talked about this on here too, the hierarchy with how we use our expressive language strategies is so important so that if you use a strategy before a kid is ready, you guarantee that he's not going to respond appropriately. And that's how choices would be. If you really give him a lot of choices before he can talk, if talking is your goal there, he has to fall back on a sign or a gesture because he doesn't have anything else yet. So save that for your kids that you know are good imitators. And I don't ever think a kid is a good imitator and ready for choices until I've heard maybe him imitate 10 or 12 words in a session or two before I really start those choices. But once you know that a kid can imitate pretty well, choices are so effective because they can really turn a kid into a full-time imitator. And then once you get a kid to that point, I almost feel like, gosh, half the battle is won because he is consistently imitating and consistently repeating words. And if he can do that with me in an hour, he can do it a lot with mom and dad during the week, and we are on our way to him really, really learning how to talk. So it's so important, but don't use choices before a kid is really, really ready, verbal choices, that is. Otherwise, you're just going to start some bad habits that are going to take a long time to move on through. Does that make sense?
Right. Does to me.
Yeah, and instinctively, you don't even do it until they're really ready to do that.
No.
Until a kid is, yeah, I don't either.
Not to say that I don't want to imply that we don't follow their lead to some extent, because the same kid that I don't, quote unquote, give a choice to, when he, in his way, tells me he's done, I generally respect what he is indicating and I go on to something else, but I'm not giving him a choice. But I am intentionally trying to choose things that I think he'll like or I hope that he'll like.
Right.
And I do follow his lead on done, but not necessarily for the choice.
For the beginning, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I think choices are so effective, but again, you save those to when a kid can really verbally imitate you and you'll go a long way in not having a kid who gets stuck in that I'm just going to point or I'm just going to sign phase. You save it for when they're really verbally ready to imitate pretty consistently. And again, my unofficial marker for that is I've heard 10 or 12, they've imitated 10 or 12 different words in a previous session. That's when I start to think, okay, this is when you're ready for choices. And don't email me. I don't have a reference on that. That's just from doing this job for a long time. You can quote me as your reference on that if you need a reference or whatever. So
there
anyway,
you go.
Silly about that. Okay, the next thing that I would recommend that she do is, and we talked about this last week too, is really use those rules for withholding. And so she's saying that she knows he can, and she says a couple of toddlers. So again, I think you pointed out, Kate, that it probably is that, since this is more than one kid, it probably is that she's looking at it. She needs to change philosophically how she thinks about that kids would purposely not talk. But if she feels like that's not the case, then she maybe hasn't learned how to pleasantly push in the context of withholding so that he really thinks, boy, I better say it to get it. And remember, though, the big rule of withholding, though, is it has to be fun. It can't be mean. But you really have to say, you know, tell me, say it, you know, and I could just hear you saying that, and I say that all the time when you're really doing that kind of pleasantly insisting that he try with that. And again, the other big rule with withholding is that, but you only withhold 3 to 5 times, and then you give it to them anyway, even if they don't do it, so that they still want to stay with you and play and don't think you're the meanest person they've ever met, don't fall into tantrums and, you know, have a holy fit so that it disrupts your whole entire session. You still want to be sure that you're using the rules for withholding, but at the same time pushing enough so that they really feel compelled to, oh boy, if I want that Skittle, I better say candy or whatever, more or whatever word you're using for that. And again, that's an art, and you have to really hone your skills there and really develop some good instincts about when you're about to push a kid over the edge and when you can use withholding and when it's not really appropriate for you to keep, again, that pleasantly pushing and being pretty persistent about they say it. And that's something that just takes lots and lots of practice with kids individually and then throughout your whole caseload, you know, holistically on your part to be able to read when you can push a kid and when you can't. But I would take a look at
that, or as a foundation for that, that's why the warm and fuzzy, loving connection is so important, because if a kid trusts you on that level, it's like you're going to get their best effort possible. You know,
right.
If you have them on the social thing, if they adore you the way you adore them, and the truth is, you know, that's the thing about being that kind of therapist. If you're the warm and fuzzy, gotta love them, they've gotta love you therapist, it's so much more rewarding anyway that,
right.
You know, it's, I always joke that I get paid to be the world's greatest grandma. You know, I get to go in and take wonderful toys and play and use treats, and it's, you know, but then the kids do, you get their best effort. You know, I can't say I get it 100% of the time, but I'm not always at 100% myself. I feel like if I have set the ground, the stage for that, and I'm on and I'm giving it my best, I'm reasonably confident in during most sessions that I'm getting the kids' best, too. And kids' best on one day is not the same as it's going to be the next day or later that day, or, you know, they vary just as we all vary. So,
right.
Anyway.
But that's a good point. And the article that I referred her to with learning how to use withholding and make kids just a teeny tiny little bit frustrated so that they can, I think about, they have to go over the hurdle, and they need to have just a little bit of a push for them to be able to say that word. On the website, there's an article called A Little Frustration Can Go a Long Way, and it's talking about the appropriate ways to use withholding and sabotage. And in the new therapy manual, Teach Me to Talk, the therapy manual, the whole section on withholding begins on page 162, and I got an email from a therapist this week who said, I've not ever really looked at withholding that way, and thank you for telling me what those rules were, because I've just been sitting there waiting until a kid can say it before I necessarily would ever give him anything. And I think, boy, that's a lousy way to spend an hour for you and for the kid, because that would be pretty darn frustrating if they couldn't really do it. And again, this person believes that a child is able to say the word. So if that's really true, and all those other things that we've talked about led up until now, withholding may help push that kid over the edge. But again, I'm not meaning withholding in that you stand there and, you know, you model it 55 times before you would even think that he might be ready to say it. You know, the ground rule is 3 to 5 times. So take a look at that article in the new therapy manual for those rules for withholding so that she can take a look at that. And again, I think that whole pleasantly pushy, boy, doesn't that really pretty much describe the whole approach? You want to be fun. You want to be sweet. You want to be nice so that kids like you and want to do it, but you still have to push just a teeny bit so that there's a reason for them to try to imitate a verbal word. And again, that's for kids that are ready. you don't do it right away with a lot of our kids on our caseload. It takes months to kind of get them to that point where they're really ready for you to withhold and push them a little bit. But if it's a kid who really can say the word, it could be that she has to up her game a little bit so that she's requiring that word in a really nice, fun, you can do it kind of way, which, again, takes some practice and takes some time to develop your own ability to do that. The DVDs, I think that's the best reason for a therapist who might be struggling in this area. Get Teach Me to Talk, my first DVD that I did, because there are tons of examples on there of that pleasantly withholding and giving choices and doing things in a way that would facilitate a child to respond to you in a positive way instead of turning him off and doing it incorrectly so that you end up killing that opportunity for him to repeat what you've said or give you the word spontaneously or whatever level he's at. So that might be an idea for her to look at some examples of how to do it and how to keep it fun and how to keep it on a level where a kid still wants to stay with you, because sometimes people do it and the kid walks away like, I don't want anything else to do with you. Forget it. It is not worth it to me. I didn't want the cookie that bad in the first place.
Right.
So you've got to really get them ready for that. And, you know, it takes a while to learn to do that and have that work for you and be successful, rather than either being a pushover so that you're not pushing the kid hard enough to try to give you that response, or going the other way and being too mean about it so that you drive him away because he can't do it and you've set the bar so high that there's no way that he can possibly do what you've asked him to do. So you lose him either way. You want to find that happy medium where you're in the middle, and that just takes developing, you know, practicing and developing your own style so that you can do it and keep kids with you and keep them wanting to ask you for whatever you have, how many ever times in a row that you require that. And that those things are on the DVDs. And it's almost harder for me to talk about how to do it than if you just watch it and see it, because you can imitate about anything that you see, don't you think? It's easy to do it when you see somebody do it.
I remember years ago, Laura, co-treating with you and thinking, aha, now I get that ratcheted up. Now I get that playfully withholding. Now I get that. Because, yeah, it's one of those things that if you see it, I think two things that a lot of therapists would be, well, let's say this, two things that caught my attention early on when I actually saw you doing it many years ago was, one, how up you really are, how animated, how playful, how silly, how everything. I mean, everything is just over-the-top exaggerated. And I know you used to write years ago when you would write strategies, and I'm sure you still write it in some way, shape, or form about if you don't feel pretty silly doing it, you're not being exaggerated enough. You need to, you know,
yeah.
And that is, the first thing is that, is how up you really need to be. I think people tend not to appreciate exactly what that looks like, or it would be easy not to if you weren't looking at the DVD or watching you in person doing it. And then, what was my other point? The playfulness and the... there was some
It'll
other...
It'll come back to you in a minute.
Okay.
It'll come back
I'm
to you in a minute.
I'm thinking about it.
Okay. Yeah, and I do think you can hear somebody say all day long, you know, you've got to use a heightened level. You've got to really demonstrate over-the-top affect. You have to be animated. And you sometimes people think that they're already doing that until you have a point of comparison. And then you see someone else who's really spent a long time learning how to do that and crafting that, And then you think, oh, no, I wasn't there yet. And so that's why I think the DVDs are so helpful, because some people really think that they're being playful. But we all have different, you know, we all come to this game with different personalities and different strengths and different weaknesses and different experiences that might make someone less inclined to be like that. Like you had a, that person tell you not to call the kid honey or sweetie or whatever. Somebody might have had, you know, working with an older child saying, no, you've got to be more
authoritative.
Business-like or, and so that might have colored your whole approach when it was in out of context. With toddlers, you really do have to be that much fun and that excited, and you can fake it. And you say that all the time, and I certainly fake it. I mean, I just kind of I don't know that faking it is the right word, but that's, I just do my thing. I mean, that's
something
just
you turn
how
on.
I do
it.
It
is a routine.
Yeah.
It is part of your therapy approach. Yeah, it's not faked. Sometimes there are certainly times before I'm getting ready to go in and see a child and think because of I stayed up too late or because there's some family situation that's plaguing me and I think, oh, I can't be fun. I just don't feel like playing like that. But, you know, when you go in and you do switch on the on button and you're up and you're on, kids do so much better that it's so rewarding that it makes you get that much more into it. And, you know, so often I think, I can't do another kid.
Yeah, and
just don't
what?
Have it
you
in
do
me.
Do another
then,
kid.
Yeah. And then you go in and you see them, you know, they give you the look when you get to their door. Or they see it getting out of your car and their eyes are already twinkling. And you think, okay, it goes so much better when you bring that to the table that it's once you know how to do it and it becomes automatic, which is, I guess, what we're saying is that it really can become automatic. And
it
once
can,
it does,
then
it just you just turn it on and you think, even if you thought you didn't have it to give, you always do because the kids do so much better that really, even though you're up and you're expending more energy, it's so much more fulfilling and so much more rewarding and so much more fun that you do it by instinct.
You do, and it's your autopilot. Once you
practice
it enough and once you do it, four kids, five kids, six kids, how many ever kids you see in a day, you know, 3, 4, 5 days a week over several months, you know, weeks and months and years, it really is your autopilot. I mean, you really can turn it on even when you think you can't. But it is hard work at the beginning.
Yes, it is.
Especially if that's not your normal personality, especially
mm-hmm.
if that's not how you've practiced. So you've got to retrain yourself to be that way. But you can. I mean, it's entirely doable, entirely doable. My last point that I wanted to make about this, and I can't believe I just looked at the time. We're almost done. I can't believe that I just can't believe it. This hour is my fastest hour the whole week, every week. But the last point I want to make to her, and I think we talked about this a little bit last week, and I talked to you about it whatever day I talked to you on the phone, Kate. This is specifically about a kid I saw on Friday, so I guess it was Friday afternoon. And this would certainly apply in this situation for her. She needs to start with words that she really has heard the kids say and not, and we talked about this earlier in the show, you don't really assume that a kid can say a word unless you've actually heard him do it. So you start with something that's easy for him that's automatic. And I've got a good story to tell from my session that I have with a little boy on Friday. I am supposed to see this little boy a couple times a month, but with my or two times a month. He has other wonderful therapists that see him more frequently than I do, but I see him twice a month, and he is doing great. He's a micro preemie. He's a kid. I was his second speech therapist, but I'm his first speech therapist at home. He was doing some an outpatient clinic for speech before we mentioned program. But I happened to see him at grandmother's house, which I've never seen him at grandmother's house before. I had met grandma one other time. She was at a session at his home, and I typically see him at home with his mom. Sometimes his dad is there too. But my point is, he was in a totally different environment. He has not seen me for close to a month because he was sick when I was supposed to see him last time. I've had a crazy travel schedule in July, so you know, it's been about a month. But boy, did he need some time to warm up to me, because we already had those two big differences. He's looking at me like, what are you doing here at my grandmother's house? Hey, and I don't know if I remember you or not, because, boy, it's been a while. So with a kid like that, you have to start with things that you know that he can do. So for this little guy, I'm so proud of him. He's making great progress. He has 30, 40, maybe even close to 50 words that he says spontaneously. But I didn't start with lots of those words. I started with uh-oh and go and words that were, and we, and those exclamatory play words that we talk about all the time, words that I know that he likes to say. He likes potato heads, and he nearly always will, you know, we have our little routines that we do. So I really started with him with really familiar activities to him. And his grandmother said to me, I notice that you're not really saying lots of new words to him today. And I said, that's because he's so quiet right now. I know that I could never start with him with getting him to say something I've never said before. I've got to start with him where I know he can be successful. And that's going to be, you know, the words that you're hearing me say. She said, yeah, those are words he says all the time. And lo and behold, within about 30 seconds of Grandma saying that, he started to pop those little words out. So you start way back before your newest kind of words. You start with those really well-established words that a kid has said a lot when you're trying to move them forward with getting them to talk to you, especially on a day when you think it even sort of crosses your mind that he is, for whatever reason, holding out on you or whatever. You don't start with those newer, more difficult words. You start way back with things that he really has said over and over and over and over and over.
Because
that's going to be
easy. You know,
I do that
with a lot of my kids, Laura. I think of it as a little stretching or a little warming up exercise,
yeah.
Where particularly I think that's the most natural thing with kids, I suspect, are praxic. I feel like, okay, they need that warm-up, and they need those early, easy successes so that their little verbal motor's running and they're feeling more confident. And then I kind of try and move them along to, you know, novel words or less well-rehearsed words. Because I feel like you're asking them to run 10 miles, and you didn't even give them 5 minutes to exercise, to stretch.
Right.
So go in there and make it easy initially, and then they're feeling pretty good, and you are too, and you're ready to go.
Exactly. So. But Grandma's point was, okay, you're here for speech therapy, so why are you starting on stuff he can already say?
Uh-huh.
And again, she said it in a much nicer way. But that was her point. Like, gosh, I expected you to come in here trying to teach him some new words, but all I hear you really trying to get him to say, and by trying to get him to say, she means that I was really modeling and looking at him like, okay, your turn, you need to say that, with uh-oh and those kinds of, you know, silly animal sounds and our silly little routines. She had only seen speech once, so she wasn't highly familiar with me or what we do, but her point was, I expected you to come in and try new things from the get-go, not the stuff that you know we can already say. And my point to her was, man, he's really quiet today. You know, I've been here how many ever minutes, and we've hardly heard anything. So we better start with what we know he can do and work him forward. And that would be my point to her. Perhaps she's thinking that a kid can say it, and I said this at the beginning of the show, because she's heard him pop it out one or two times. You don't really start with those words, and especially when a kid has shut down on you or you never have quite gotten him going for a particular session, sometimes it's that you're picking things that are too hard. So you back way up and start at a point that you know he can be successful. And for that little boy, you know, I'm sitting there thinking, what does he say every week? He always says go. He always says uh-oh. He always says we. He always, you know, whatever. And so you run through your little mental list of words he owns that he says consistently, and you start with those. And, again, you kind of work him up. And isn't it funny how every single point, all these five or six ideas, all kind of overlap and go together and are a little bit repetitive. And thank goodness it is that way. And thank goodness this doesn't just work with this kind of kid. These ideas pretty much work with everybody that we've talked about today. But it especially works in a situation where a kid, for whatever reason, is not being as verbal as you think that he can be. Whether it's the personality thing that we talked about, whether it's that you haven't quite gotten him up enough to play, whether, you know, whatever the reason, these are really good ideas that work with most of the children that you're going to see on your caseload. So that was a good kind of general question, and so I'm glad that we got an opportunity to talk about that. Did you remember the point that you forgot a second ago? And it's okay if you didn't.
No, I did. One was the two things, the level of arousal that you use, how animated you are, and then I guess the playfulness with the withholding. How,
yeah.
And I think that's something that a lot of therapists kind of miss, too, is that they get right into the, you know, I'm going to demand it. And we're demanding
right.
it, but it's in a much more animated, playful, and kids get that a lot. Most of the kids we see, I think, get that
yeah.
on some level. They know that's part of the game. And
right.
they are encouraged to, you know, they were more likely to get their best effort with them thinking it's a playful game we're playing than, okay,
right.
that adult walked in here, held out this cool thing, and demanded that I set it. Because 2-year-olds
right.
are really quick to, you know, fight the fight.
and say, there's your line. Guess what? Here's my
yep.
line.
And in
yeah.
an hour's time, they win a lot of them, you know. So,
yeah.
anyway, I guess that was it, was how playful in general you need to be and animated and over the top. My one of my standard lines as well. I used to say my biggest competition is Blue's Clues. I don't know who it would be now, who's the latest and greatest, and the Mickey Mouse Clubhouse show or the, you know, I mean,
yeah.
these are very animated, very playful things that kids gravitate to, so... That's who you have to compete with. It has to be very animated and seeing years ago. Yes, and to
yeah.
hold it and to get their best, it has to be. And then just how playful you are about withholding. And as you said, the stage has to be set early on that they know everything you do there is playful. Everything, every
right.
interaction is positive to, you know, with a few exceptions, and we sure try and avoid the exceptions, you know, that's what we want them to learn, is that when Laura's here, Kate's here, whatever therapist is here, it's fun, and they want to be part of it.
And you are going to have a blast, so participate, yeah. And again, that takes some time to develop that, and it takes some practice. The DVDs will help anybody, though, who isn't quite sure what we're talking about on that. You can
because
see
I
that.
Because I think a lot of times, Laura, and I don't mean to bash other therapists, it's just that I think not being a speech therapist, I cross paths with speech therapists, and I think a lot of that's often by veterans and new therapists alike, something that they assume they do. And
right.
They
until you have a point of comparison, yeah.
Right. And that's, I think,
right.
was my primary point about watch the DVD so that, you know, you see it. And if
right.
you're not in that ballpark, then you need to rethink, are you really playful? Are you really you
right.
know, getting them on
right.
that? Because I thought I was oh so many years ago when I crossed paths with you, and then I left kind of scratching my head thinking, I need to rethink that. I need to work on that. And it wasn't.
Yeah, and again...
Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, and if it doesn't come natural to you, that's okay. And some therapists, I think, will balk and say, well, that's just not my personality. I'm not going to do it. And I just say, well, you can keep doing what you're doing and see if that worked for you, how that works for you.
Right.
Or
have
you
lots of successes
and
feel great
yeah.
about it. And it is, you know, like
yeah.
I said, it was not as natural for me. Not that I'm a shy wallflower by any stretch, but the level was beyond what I thought I was doing it until I saw you do it. And then I thought, okay, now I get it. When
right.
she says,
and it is hard
it
for
up.
Some people.
Yes.
Yeah. It's hard for some people. And some moms will tell me, I just, you know, kind of pretend that I do it like you. I just kind of copy you.
Right.
And then it becomes your own style. Then it becomes your own therapy persona. I mean, I still kind of think before I walk in a kid's house, it's showtime because
right.
that's, you know, that's what you're there for. And for some kids, you are not going to get good enough responses until you think and get yourself that up they're not really ready to perform back. And some therapists really bite this and say, well, that's not natural. That's not in the midst of daily routines. Play should be the crux of a toddler's daily routine. With playing, that's what kids do. That's how kids learn. It doesn't have to be the whole flip the flashcard with both of you sitting at the table. That's not successful with toddlers. And so that reserved, very professional, almost cold, I do this, you do this, you're not going to get that with toddlers, and that's the wrong approach. You know, it does have to almost be, this is my therapy. You know, today I'm playing the part of speech-language pathologist.
For babies. Yeah.
Yeah. You have to almost think about it in that way. So, food for thought there. So we're at the end of another show, and we did not get to what our listener had asked us to do, but that's okay. We'll do that next time, and I sent you that email, Kate, so you'll have a whole week to look at it. I feel ahead of the game.
Oh, I'll be so prepared next week.
So next week we're talking about stages of play or fundamentals of play. And so we have that information from a long, long time ago. I don't even know what the source is on this that we're going to talk about. But we'll also talk about the cognitive pieces that have to be in place before a kid is even ready for this kind of play. And that's new material that I really have spent a lot of time looking at and developing and thinking about over the last 6 months. It's in the new therapy manual. In the cognitive chapter, because it's so important. Until a kid has met those prerequisites to talk, guess what? He's not going to talk. So we'll talk about what those cognitive prerequisites are next week, what you can look for in play, and how you can move a kid through these stages of play, all in an effort to get him ready to communicate. It's all related.
That was reading that I did on the plane to California. And even though I'm supposed to be developmental interventionist, some of it was revelationary, or whatever the word, a revelation to me. So, good
stuff.
You go. We'll talk about it next week.
There you go. Thanks. Bye.
Okay. Bye.